How about an opening statement?
You have to speak up because I just got off like, vacation. I still got water in my ear.
How is that?
Oh, it's great.
We used to go to
planning another movie?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And we're going to remake the Blues Brothers. Only expensive. Big, you know.
Yeah, we found out you can make a lot of money doing this stuff. You know.
Yeah. We didn't find out on our last movie, but this movie we found out.
Earl Chisholm, the Chicago Defender. Which do you think you find that fits you most, the live bit or the records or the movie?
They're all. We've done pretty well in about all.
I mean, your personal preference, you know.
Our personal thing? Well, movies right now, you know, because you can do it over if you didn't do it right. And it's, we at this stage, it's movies. But every stage that we went through was, we had the same sort of feeling, you know. It's
about like movies because your face is up there so big.
Yeah.
And your zits are that big. In proportion.
Thinking about doing some television tape.
Not really. Not, you know. I mean,
the screen is too small.
Yeah. No, we're a little more, you know, one thing at a time. We're one thing at a time, guys. And sometimes no things at a time.
Mostly no things at a time.
We're the opposite of workaholics.
We're restaholics. Mm. We like to rest.
Playaholics, yeah.
Yes, sir.
How much of this was impromptu, the movie? I mean, how much was script and how much did you script and make it?
Well, we had an outline when we started, which
sort
we showed Universal, kind of. We had a 10-page outline and told them we're going to go from, these are the things we're going to do. Ah, they blanched. And then we wrote a little more, and then they didn't blanch so much, and they gave us some money. But basically, we did what we did in the outline. That was the movie. So we go into a scene with the basis of what we were going to do and then improv off it. You know, so you didn't, because I can't remember lines, you know, really.
Except the ones on a table, you know.
Oh, yeah, who had that line there? I went out of the room and now it's gone. Yeah, so it wasn't some matter of the what exactly we said, it was how we said it or the information that we wanted to get across. You know, so.
We use the same technique we did when we do a live show. It looks spontaneous, and it is to some part, but some of the spontaneity is what we did last night, you know. We keep the good spontaneity and we get rid of the bad spontaneity.
That really should be the objective of improv, you know. I mean, if you're going to see an improv company, it's like, most of it's like watching paint dry, you know. And for you sit there for an hour and a half until one thing that cracks you up. We try to limit it all the rest of that shit and just concentrate on the one good thing.
Do you think some of the material might have been a little offensive?
Hope so. A lot of money in that, you know. That's what they said when we sold them the deal. Well, as long as it's really rude and there's a lot of...
Can you put some more dope in it?
And
you know,
vulgar and a lot of drugs.
Yeah.
You know. And people say, you know, what are the tower thing? Or, you know, the guys with the suits and ties. They want, can you get more dirty jokes in there?
Yeah.
Last night when I got my wrote the review, and the first three words that came out was there was a lot of implications of drugs, sex, and noise.
Mm-hmm. That's a good review for us.
Not to say it's bad.
Yeah. No, we're not trying to be good. We're just trying to be funny and loud and boisterous. And
noisy.
And
sexy and druggy.
Yeah, we just want to, you know, the things that make America great.
Yes, sir.
What's your budget?
Budget?
For
today? Like this today? Or?
No.
Oh. We're over the budget.
So don't
take
no more.
Costs less than the Blues Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
How much?
Oh, yeah. About $55 million less.
Give
or take a few hundred thousand.
It depends on who's telling the budget.
Yeah. And it depends if we're trying to make another deal, we did it for under $2 million.
Yeah,
and if we're trying to impress someone, it costs around $7-8 million, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And if you talk to Universal accountants, it's
costs
we still owe them money.
Yeah.
A guy from the Illinois Entertainer in Chicago. You did some pretty new topical things in the movie this time, but nothing about the new draft proposals. this is more directed towards you.
Yeah. Well, we figure that ignorance is bliss, and that is our approach to it. I don't think you should register, so we just completely ignored it. That's what I did when the draft came around, huh? Well, no, I'm sorry, I gave it the office.
You know. I'm busy that day.
These guys are not draftless, not even in there, unless they get like caught stealing something or something, and they get three choices: Army, Navy, Marines. You know.
Archie Darren's in Dallas newspaper is Detroit, Michigan.
Yeah, well, I like to say about that.
What type of car was that in the final scene? The one you used, do you remember that thing?
The final scene.
Yeah, the little Ferrari.
Oh, that was a Dino Ferrari.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just seeing the look on the guy's face, you know, he's one of these car buffs that. You know, he knew the right polish to use. And they rented it for a Cheech and Chong movie. So the first thing Cheech does is walk over the end of it and step on the paint.
Hey, wow, look at this thing. And they got... Okay, then we drove it out on the end of the field. Hey, this is great. And the guy had a heart attack.
He quit coming to the set. He couldn't take it. He was devastated. So was the car.
That was our most lavish thing.
Well, talk to people from, say, National Lampoon or something like that.
We don't tackle.
Well, in our video or something like that, he says that the people that work for him went to television and sort of lost their edge, their creative edge. Then they went to movies and they lost it even further.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they could get double hot tubs and a bad cocaine hat. Is that what draws you to movies? Is it the money that can be made off of a movie is so much better than, say, playing with television or being more experimental in the records and everything else?
Well, movies to us is an easier media because then we're not restricted. You know, you could we were too old when we got into the comedy field to be influenced by people that telling you what you could do or what you can't do. We just did what we could do the best we could do it. And it was totally unacceptable for television, but it was acceptable for movies, you know. And so that ended up being our media. Now, through that, we found out later that you can make a lot of money doing that. And so we put the two together and figured, hell, this is real good.
Yeah. We learned that first day in class, one and one.
Yeah. But as far as the money end of it goes, like we learned during our record career, you know, how fleeting, you know, it can be with creative accounting. So we figured a way that the only way you could beat it, you know, the system is to stay away from the, you know, the cocaine habits and the hot tub parties and all that. And just, you know, like both of us are physical fitness buffs in a sense, you know, that we stay in shape so we could do all those drugs, you know, without it affecting our brain that much, you know. So we got it pretty well licked. We, you know, yeah, you really have to be in good shape to be rich.
One of the reasons that a lot of people think Up in Smoke was such a great success was because the audience kept going back because they were so screwed up, they didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. Are you hoping for the same effect?
Oh, yeah.
We're hoping for double the impact, actually. Because we figured that the weed has got stronger over the years.
And their brains got weaker. So now they'll forget as soon as they walk out of the theater.
So we made the screen larger and the music louder. So you have to change with the times.
No, when we did our albums, we have to keep entertaining ourselves, you know, so we'd because we have to listen to them over and over again, we put the sound effects and so on in. So we developed sort of like a style where we would put things, even in the movie, put things that you could watch again and again, and then, you know, you could watch something else each time we'd seen the movie. And we put those things in this movie, too. And hoping that when people do come back, because, you know, that's part of the trip now. You know, I've seen it 18 times. Wow. So that they could get something out of it. Instead of, yes, sir.
Hey, Tony DeSanta from the Aquarium. You plan on going on the road, doing any tours?
This is it, fellas. No, we're just...
Would you like to see the dinner show?
No, no more shows for a while. No.
We're into the movie years.
Yeah, it conflicts with our our movie image in a way, you know, like people see us on the screen and they want us to do that for the whole show, and it's almost like misleading advertising to come out and do a show where you're not that character. It's actually disappointing, you know, for some people.
We went on the road after Up in Smoke, and that's the reaction.
Yeah.
Did you do a film, like a live concert film, say the way Richard Pryor did?
Not at this stage, no.
We got a tape that we might bootleg. of our 1976 show. Yeah. It was, we were hot then. No, we don't see it at that. We never did. Like for our recordings, we never did them live either. We approached each one with a different, you know, with straight on rather than trying to do two things at once. It works better for
especially
us.
Especially for that reason, too, because he. A live show, if you're going to take it around for a good many years, and it's put a really good comedy show together, it takes around 10 years. And you show it once, and there's 10 years' work, boom, goodbye, next show. Okay, they don't grow on trees, you know, so we kept our live show live, so you had to come and actually be there to see it.
Yeah, because a lot of it depends on the time of night, the setting. You know, yeah,
or non-sobriety.
yeah, a lot of it. There's too many variables to. But I mean, Pryor could do it.
Who I know you. I was reading the production notes. You guys are not particularly influenced by any team, but a comedy team. But who, in your opinion, is among the top comedy teams professionally from your professional aspect?
I think. Carter and Reagan are probably the best. The new breed.
Seems, yeah, there's some. Bob and Ray are probably our favorite teams of all time.
Newcomers,
okay. Yeah. they're just classic. They work on very simple premises, much like ourselves.
Sonny Terry and Brian McGee. Yeah. Pretty cool, okay.
There's not many teams around, you know, because it.
It's hard to get along with one guy for a long time.
Yeah, it is, basically. You know, I mean, you have to really give up. It's like learning how to play guitar. You know, on one hand, you have to develop a real light touch and sensitivity, and the other hand, you have to develop big calluses. You know, to hold down positions that are totally foreign to you. You know, so, and once you, if you get those two hands coordinated, well, then you get music, and otherwise, it takes long hours, and you're doom, 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 doom. And a lot of people don't want to go through that.
I'm like being married.
Yeah, very much. Oh, yeah. It's neat. He doesn't have to get a divorce and just fuck off somewhere.
Is there a point, can you conceive of a point where drug humor won't get the laughs that it gets at this point in the culture? Or are you two like the Dean Martin of the alcohol set with the alcohol jokes?
Probably we are the Dean Martin of that set, but the way we treat drugs is like we just mirror the prevailing attitude about it. If you notice this film, there was no big deal. I mean, there was no paranoia involved. They walked down the street carrying a big bag full of dope, smoking it right out in the open. It's just like it is in life, you know. I mean, anyone here could walk down the street and smoke a joint. There would be no hassle at all, especially here in Boston.
It's the street attitude toward it, you know, toward the drugs. That's what we show, the street attitude, not, you know, anybody that can hold down a job or is a bit respectable, you know, you'll think twice about doing what these guys would do. But these guys, you know, they don't have any problems with paranoia. And we try to show that. And the reason... It's because no one else was doing it, you know. Everybody else, when they'd show drugs, they'd say, here's a joint, man. And they'd, boy, this is really good
stuff.
and you know, I mean, and that would, that kind of humor sort of, or that sort of approach is gone. So we take it sort of like a casual approach to it, yeah. Which most people don't.
I was thinking the other night, too, is that I really thought back on it, and either one of my characters in the movie doesn't smoke grass once. In the whole movie, and that amazed me, because you know, I'd have to put down the joint to do the scene. Oh yeah, I'll be right there, man.
That's right. Yeah. And one guy just wants to get laid, and the other guy wants to go have a good time.
Yeah.
So they
don't. Let's look at this. He just grows it.
You got to get something going.
What do you two think about freebasing?
Pardon?
Freebasing. What do you?
Hazardous to polyester shirts, man.
And it can change your complexion awfully fast if you don't do it right, you know? You get a hell of a flash from it, you know?
Well, there's good drugs and there's bad drugs, man. That's my contention. I think marijuana is a good drug. I think freebase is a bad drug. We never developed a cocaine habit. It shrinks the membranes around your wallet very differently. And so we kind of stay away from it. You know.
We couldn't handle it, thank God.
Did you hear that somebody's planning a telethon for Richard Pryor?
Oh, really? Oh, I'd like to get in on
long
that.
As long as it's legitimate. Hey, bro, you want to help Richard? Poor Richard, he's only got a few million. Give me some money. We'll get together and send him a card. Uh-huh.
In terms of the teeny bopper set, do you think they should legalize grass?
No, it would throw too many pushers out of work. I mean, there's millions of pushers now, you know, and there's kids they got to support.
The boat industries.
Yeah.
We don't want to hit that too deep right now.
And the government would lose all that money they get from selling the boats back to the dealers.
If they placed marijuana under the same conditions that alcohol is placed under right now, I'd be satisfied. Mm-hmm.
They can't, though. Because you can grow it. It's a weed, you know, you can get grandma to, grandma, will you grow this for me? And they got enough to last for a year or two. The teeny boppers, that's a whole different world, you know, that people don't understand. I mean, even because you forget, you know. But if you remember, if you think back and remember when you were a teeny bopper, you did whatever the hell you were going to do, regardless of who your parents, what anybody thought. And if it was getting high or snorting glue you know, hiding in the closet and watching your maid undress, you know, you're going to do it. So, you know, there's nothing, you know, no legislation, you know, like they say, let's outlaw head shops, you know. So what are you going to do? You're going to outlaw little things that hold a joint, you know. I mean, you can pick them up in a hardware store if you really need them.
I think they should, right? When people get back to their roots, you know, you start using paper matches again. I think it's very important. We have to remember where we came from.
Do you guys have kids yourself?
Yeah. I got four of all ages and colors.
Seriously?
Yeah.
And one on the way.
One on the way.
And I have a little daughter, ten months now.
Well, do they ever do things and say, well, you've done it before, Dad?
Oh, yeah.
Mine doesn't talk yet.
Yeah. Yeah, mine says, I'm quitting school. I said, "What? Why? Well, you did." I said, sure. Well, then you starve like I did, too. So
sure.
It works out. I got an older, a 20-year-old, all the way down to... 6-year-old, 5-year-old. Yeah, my oldest ones come by and visit my stash. They do. They walk in the house. I haven't seen him for 6 months. Oh, hi, Dad. Bye, Dad. Zoom.
Is that the attitude you think people who grew up through the 60s and maybe the 70s, now they're older, they've got jobs, they've got kids, and they have a joint before dinner every night instead of a martini?
After dinner.
No, you gotta have it before. It enhances everything else.
Yeah. Depends on how good your wife
is. Is that how they are approaching with their kids? Is that they should just, Dad, what are you doing? I'm smoking a joint. You know, this makes me high.
It's so funny.
How do you handle it?
Well, it's the opposite. Like I know families, you know, hippie families, and the daughter would come over to the dad and say, Dad, don't smoke in front of my friends, okay? They don't understand. And don't leave the shit hanging out, you know, on the table, you know, okay? Kids always lead parents around. I don't know. I did with my parents, you know. They're always somewhere behind, you know, and the kids are always up there in front. So it's the opposite. The kids more or less decide, you know. I mean, didn't you ever go in your dad's drawer? You know everything that I know my kids know everything that's going on in the house. You know. Like I'll say something, where's that? And they'll say, oh, it's in that drawer over there. Oh, look at
it. How do you know?
Yeah. They're way ahead of parents.
Do you ever worry about what influence you're having on kids who go to see your movies buy your records, your older records especially, and even the new one?
No.
All that stuff?
If we'd portrayed it in a harmful way, it wouldn't have been funny or effective. It wouldn't have worked. We've done things where you look and say, no, that ain't working. And the reason it does, the reason humor works is because you've touched a nerve of truth somewhere, for some people. And if you don't touch that nerve, it won't work, no matter what you do to it.
But it may touch the nerve of somebody who's familiar with what you're talking about. For mm-hmm. a kid who's like, you know, clean sheet and walks in and sees that mm-hmm. and says, oh, I can just go.
But they don't, I don't think you get influenced that way, you know. It's just like taking a virgin to a sex movie. You know, they say, oh, God, that's ugly. Yuck, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It only relates to you if you've done it before. Then you go, oh, yeah. You know, I get it. But other than that, you know, they laugh. Ours is a double-edged thing, you know. You can either be one of the gang or be the opposite. You're still going to laugh. You're not going to take sides. You're just
Most people
laugh.
Think that our movies are anti-drug movies.
In Canada,
who'd want to be like these guys?
Yeah, in Canada, the RCMP show our movie as a training film to
to Mounties,
not to Mounties, and to kids.
And kids, oh yeah,
and to kids to show them, you know, what happens when you do that evil. No.
Like the army training films that this man had gonorrhea.
That's right.
Yeah,
I'm serious.
Some guy told us.
Yeah, RCMP.
That cracks me up. That's
fine. I understand when you did that scene with the virgin on the stone altar, Universal couldn't supply a stone altar. Is that true?
No, they just couldn't supply the virgin.
No, Ned Tanner was using the altar. But they couldn't supply, the virgin was the hardest thing to come by.
Styrofoam altar.
Yeah, we borrowed it from Lou Wasserman's home.
Actually, that was his daughter. Yeah.
Phil Harrington, Pittsburgh Courier. Something that was personally tempting to either one of you individually came up, like a film project, would you do it without the other one?
It would have to be very tempting. And it would have to include the other one.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah. It's like, you know, you go on another project, say, and then you have to put up with a director who doesn't understand you or doesn't... Well, I got this guy broken in. He understands me.
If I did another project, I'd have to have Cheech along. Yeah. You know, we'd have to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, even if he wasn't involved in, say, in front of the camera, he'd be involved in some capacity, and vice versa, you know.
This is too much fun doing this. We have complete control over what we want to do today. Complete. And some people strive a lifetime to hit that mark, especially in films. I mean, they just really make you walk the broken bottle path, you know. And we'd be fools to give it up. This is what we like doing, it's what we do best, and we're happy doing it, really happy doing it. We get paid a lot of money, and...
We're not driven,
you
know, by any amount of knowledge and...
expertise.
We're not hampered by anything like that.
Enshrined in some anguish picture, you know, looking meaningfully up to the skies, you know.
A lot of people, you know, they find success, and they say, well, it's, you know, okay, I done that, but I really want to show you how I can do something else, and we're glad as hell we can just do this. You know, we wouldn't want to bore anybody else with anything else.
It was always the attitude we took to comedy too, because most improv groups or teams or whatever, they would sit backstage and they make up all these fun. Okay, what are we gonna do? And they make up these funny bits, because clown on what you really couldn't do. So okay, well let's get serious. We got a bit to do. And then they make up some lame stuff and then go out in the audience with their hand. Okay. Yeah. Well, we used to do the stuff that we crack up about in the dressing room. And that's been our success. Yeah.
Moving right along. I do a lot of writing about the minority images in film and TV and whatnot. Since you guys are minorities, I think.
Yeah, it's hard to tell.
Chinese. What is your impression of the images that are portrayed in the film and TV on the blacks and the Charlie Chans and those Pedro Banditos and stuff like that?
Well, those images are, for the most part, gone. There's especially in the black images, there's a wide variety of images to choose from. There are now Chicanos, there are Latinos. It's getting wider. You have ourselves, which are comedians. Everybody accepts us on that level. You have Eric Estrada on the other end. It's Pepsodent. Anyway, this is okay. I mean, you know, and I think it's widening up when the minorities are starting to become white.
Yeah, I think.
You may quote me on that.
I think we have an American style. Mm. And that's basically.
Yeah, you guys are minority type people. I mean, on.
Mm-hmm.
In a, yeah,
just people.
The best image that we could portray is two guys making a lot of money doing this. The minorities.
It's like spice, you know, like you go to cook a dish, and sometimes, like marijuana is in our movies, like a spice. Sometimes you heap in the grass, you know, mm-hmm. and sometimes, you know, just a little taste. Sometimes you put a little salsa in it, sometimes you put a little ginger in it, you know, that's how we use our minority deal and drug. And, you know, have to season to taste.
The thing is, we show the upside of it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's enough of it showing the downside, and a lot of people think, just like ghettos, they think, oh, you know, it's always this horrible, you know, downtrodden. I got to get out of here. You know, they can't stop men that want to be free.
Curse this fate to put me here.
Yeah. Well, we show the other, attitude. The humorous side of it, mm-hmm. where the guy wouldn't think of living anywhere else, and if he did, he'd turn that into a ghetto immediately anyway. You know.
Yeah.
And we learned that from being in the ghetto. Doing exactly that.
You showed the humor side of being a minority, but when I first started doing this, I seen like 13 movies in the span of 2 weeks, and all the minority parts that I seen were very subservient or menial. Okay, how would you say, if I were to get into movies, what road should I take to get away from that?
Learn how to put a towel on your wrist.
Same thing.
Yeah. No, the reason is that you're dealing with, that's what I'm saying, you know, because we're sort of uneducated and sophisticated, we show the fun side of life, whereas the other people, you know, you got to look at the credits after those kind of movies, and you'll see a lot of names that, you know, are definitely not of, you know, minority. They're educated. They're doing it from a book or a script that someone else wrote. You know, they don't have any first-hand knowledge.
The bottom line of that is that you have to believe in what you're doing so much that you'll struggle through anything to do it, and then people will come to you. I mean, most of those things arise, like Thomas says, because you're an actor doing a part in somebody else's movie, or you're this or that. My advice would be is get in your own trip and find out what you believe in and then believe in it. And then go out and may fall on your ass, and you may pick yourself up and may keep doing it. But they always have to come to you. They have to come around to your opinion, you know, if they're going to at all. You know, we've never changed our view,
and
it's come around.
The public won't accept it, you know. I mean, now people are hipper. The people that go to movies, I mean, it doesn't take much to entertain them, but it has to be real. And that's what they really like. And so the public will weed out all that other crap, you know, where they've been trying for years. And it's more of just ignorance on the filmmaker's part, you know, that they don't know, you know, a lot of them were brought up, they're slaves or they're servants. That's the only contact they had with minorities. And so that's the only role they could see a minority playing, you know. And we came up from the other side of it, so that's what makes our movies valid for everybody, because we show the other side of it.
Yeah. I see, you were the slave in the service.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly. Right, exactly. I mean, like, I never had a white-collar job until I got into movies where I, you know, where I could wear.
And our attitude,
so
too,
then you
is...
took up on a vest.
Yeah.
Our attitude, too, is not one of, well, we'll get even.
No.
And we have a very American attitude, you know, homogenized, you know, miscegenation. That's mixed with these people, you know, can produce another race, produce a half race. And I thoroughly believe in that. Mm. The best qualities of both, for beauty and intelligence.
Yeah, use it all, because you can't write off the, you know, the other, no one. I think it's totally American. I mean, even the race problems or the minority problems. It's just an American thing, you know, how we handle it and everything else. You know, because I've been abroad in Europe, and they have a misconception too, you know. They think that all the blacks here are treated like dogs, and you know, that no one has a say, and you know, the whites, and you know, they have all this misconception, you know. And problems. It's just an American thing, you know, how we handle it and everything else. You know, because I've been abroad in Europe, and they have a misconception too, you know. They think that all the blacks here are treated like dogs, and you know, that no one has a say, and you know, the whites, and you know, they have all this misconception, you know. And
semi-misconception.
Yeah.
Sure. But you realize this thing, like old TV shows, Willie Best shows and stuff like that, are hitting middle Europe now.
Yeah, sure.
And so this is the image they're sending over.
Yeah, but they're also getting new images.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner or Willie Best.
That's it. And it's the image. And but when they get up in smoke, you know, then it.
Then it kind of turns around. Movie. That's the beauty of movies. Yeah. You can be everywhere at once. Yeah. The globe shrinks. I mean, just chew, man. You know, it's a jet age. Definitely, planets hooked up electronically, and all you gotta do is feed something one end of the computer, and it's in pago before I get out of this room. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really
we find the people that get upset the most with what we do are white liberals that feel that
they should
take the guilt of the whole world on their shoulders, and you know, why don't we feel the same way? But we've never had any problems because we refuse to, you know what I mean? Like when we come across a, say, a racist idiot, we just change idiots. See?
So your next movie will probably follow along the same lines as
probably
this one.
Somewhat.
It's what's the basis of our movies is following these guys through scenes you don't get to see and their attitude, you know. So we trip with them whatever's happening in society at the time, you know. You see how their monomania relates to it, you know.
Like the bathroom scene.
Which bathroom?
I believe it was your bathroom scene. Out the window on the guy's head.
Oh, yeah.
It's something you don't normally see in movies.
I think you're getting to see a lot more of it now, which I think speaks well of Hollywood, starting to loosen up, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like when you pissed on a guy, you know? Here's another $2 million.
That's a pisshead joke, what can I say? You know?
Well, the reason I brought that up, was that like an attack towards society or an attack towards any image or just out of fun?
No, you had to piss out the window. The toilet was full.
Well, I mean, the whole towards him, everything was just that particular guy. He was...
Well, we had developed him further.
We know a guy, like, there's in the ghettos or in the poor areas, there's always one guy that refused to move. You know, I bought this house and I'm going to stay here.
1923?
Yeah. You know, and the whole world's closing in on him, you know, encroaching on his property, you know. And he keeps the lawn mowed, but there's a ton of kids hanging around there. And I've always known, and I've always sort of lived next door to those types.
And you don't mean to drive him crazy, but you just do by being there. Yeah, and that's how we viewed that guy.
I grew up in Canada, I remember. We moved from the country into this little quiet little neighborhood. we lived in the woods, you know. We used to, my brother and I, you know, we had these bowie knives. We used to practice throwing at anything wood. And so we practiced on this guy's fence for a while. And this is, you know, I mean, just totally alien to the neighborhood. But, you know, we felt comfortable doing it. Pretty soon the for sale signs. Oh.
Well, I noticed that the fellow that he was talking about was in the paperback book considerably more. I noticed there was a little discrepancy between what was in the book and what was in the film. Was that because when you finally got the book together, you hadn't fully edited the film yet?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a lot of things that we cut out of the movie, you know, to make it a better movie.
Who decided to cut the stuff out, both you guys together?
The movie? Yeah. Oh, yeah, we both, we look at it.
We edit.
Argued and screamed and hollered.
Music store scene's shorter in the movie now, isn't it?
Yeah. There was a longer scene there, but it's...
Didn't work?
It didn't work. Goodbye.
Yeah. It didn't work.
In fact, the Blues Brothers did that sort of thing, didn't influence you in any way.
What's that?
No.
The music?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, they tromp in the music store and wind out for a while. And,
I seen the Blues Brothers, and there's a lot of coincidences, you know, sort of like... but there's a lot of things, too, you know... from the era that we're coming from, and you know, in terms of movie making, and same as them.
How they relate to music?
Yeah,
we had a scene of Red going wild in the music store, but it didn't work. It was too long, and it was for nothing. There was no reason.
Didn't get a laugh.
Yeah. So yank, find a neat place to edit it where it makes semi sense, and then keep the guys going.
Two things happen: if it's not getting a laugh, it'll ruin another laugh.
Yeah.
And if you take it out, it'll enhance the
other
laugh.
It's like crying wolf.
Yeah, it'll get up there. So that's two things happen when you edit like that. You know, you enhance the laugh that's already a laugh. It's a bigger laugh, and that's the thing. You can't fall in love with things in the movie.
We came up with this theory when we worked stage for so long. It's one dildo joke per show. All you can do, man. The second time it ain't funny. It's gross. It's like, here comes the dildo again. You know? And that's it.
That's our rule of comedy.
That's our rule of thumb.
did Lou Adler actually direct the first one?
He thought he did.
He directed his name on the credits.
Oh, that's what I mean, yeah. I mean, basically. Was it you
he
running
sat
behind
the counter? And the, no, I actually, we always did, you know, work, you know, where I would direct. But we'd discuss, and then I'd direct. And that's what happened was Up in Smoke, too.
A lot of it got out of our hands because he wanted to make.
Yeah.
Everybody has their own idea of a movie, you know. Mm-hmm. And they want to.
You get caught up. You get caught up with the power, and you got the camera and everything. Well, what do you want to do now, sir? And it got. In fact, it got a little. There was conflict in the first movie because I just automatically was directing a lot of scenes, and so the cameramen and people were starting to come to me for their direction. And it made Lou look a little silly. And in fact, at one point he fired a cameraman, you know, because of that relationship. And so I had to back off. And unfortunately, you could see it in the film where I did, because then Lou would take over and he had no conception of what we were doing, a comedy or nothing, because, you know, he never spent the years that we spent doing it. Because that's how you learn. You got to spend those years getting burned, you know, in front of an audience. So that, then you automatically know where you can go and where you can't go, and what's going to work, what's not going to work, you know.
Is that what went wrong to all the people from, say, Saturday Night Live when they made the jump to movies? Because if you listen to your records and had seen your shows, you knew what you're going to see in Up in Smoke and Saw It, and you knew what you're going to see in your new movie, and you see it.
If you
watch Saturday Night Live, the humor there does not, they don't do it in the films.
And it's sad.
Is that directors?
Well, yeah, they split up the band, man.
Yeah, that's right. It is directors, and it is, you know, actors that. Because you get influenced by your director, because you never know if he's right or wrong until the movie's finished and it's too late. And it definitely is.
Yeah.
Because actors will just do whatever anybody tells them to do. If you want them to be funny, they'll be funny. And if you just say, okay, just walk in the door, okay, hit this mark. Oh, that's great. Fantastic. We loved it. And they'll do that. Yeah, I think that's the sad part. I also think, too, is like what we tried to do is that when we established our image, we just wanted to make sure that that's what the people were going to see. You know, no disappointments.
And some of the Saturday Night Live people are trying to change their image, you know? Because it's not, the only thing that was funny that anybody did that probably was Animal House, and Belushi really wasn't a star or anything in that, but it was run by people from Lampoon.
Yeah.
But the rest of it isn't. Do you think they're screwing it up by letting somebody else take it over?
Yeah, definitely.
Well,
it's like a club, you know, when we used to go out and play clubs. Really a nice little intimate club, man, a little stage. Everybody came down because it was happening. Boy, it was a nice place to meet people, see a good show, blah, blah. And it gets real successful. And the owner says, yeah, I'm going to tear out this wall, make three stages, and then we'll have two bars going here. And everybody goes, yeah, great. See you later. And the place goes right down. We've seen it happen a million times.
You break up the winning combination, you know. Once you get a combination going, you break it up. Like, I think Maddie Simmons probably played a big role in Animal House, because what he did, what good producers do, is make you think about it twice. You know, even like a good producer, he may not know comedy on his own, but he'll say, I don't know, maybe you should do something else, and so you say, okay, well, let's go over it again. And then you come up with something, you know, we got this idiot here telling us, you know, and he might come up with some lame thing that might work, you know? And if you don't have that happening, then it's, hey, you're real funny, JR, or baby, and you don't get that double, that thinking about it twice or three times to really make sure it's going to be funny.
Sieve, you know? Yeah. You needed some sieves at some point.
I think breaking up the combination, or even what you do in one guy, like Stallone when he got Rocky, that good Rocky character, you know? And anytime you wanted to see, when you heard of Stallone, you thought of this guy. Then when you seen him in something else, doesn't matter how great he is. Hey, that's no Stallone.
Hey, why is Rocky wearing a suit?
You talked about breaking up a winning combination, but didn't Adler produce your albums also?
We
the
produced
same
our
way.
Albums.
Yeah, the same way.
He produced his name on the cover.
Question. Did he produce your albums the way he directed your
movies?
Yeah, the
same
yeah.
way. The same way.
We knew he was never ever in the studio with
Lou,
us once.
Lou's expertise was in the promotion of our albums.
You made a merchandise.
Of the merchandising promotion.
He was already rich.
Yeah.
Because he's a genius to doing that end of it.
That end, yeah, of details. The details that we couldn't stand, he would take care of. He is a pro at that, you know.
So how'd you get him out of this one?
Kicked him out.
But he made a lot of money for you last year.
We made mostly the money for him.
Yeah.
The on Lap of Smoke, we saw very little, almost none of that money. It was a 90-10 his way.
It was a divorce. We divorced. It was an amicable divorce.
Who got the
Sony? Who got the what?
The Sony.
The Sony?
He got the Sony and the daughter.
Yeah. Well, is that one of the reasons why you record your records for Warner Brothers now, as opposed to...
Well, Lou sold the label to Warner Brothers.
Oh, so it is on owed Warner Brothers?
It's still, yeah, it's on owed Warner Brothers, when and if we ever record again.
No, Lou just wants to do, wanted to... get creative himself, you know, something that where he could really, especially with movies, you know, because he wants to be a director, and you couldn't have two directors, and so we split.
Look, you guys use the word unencumbered by such things as plots and scripts and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
And if a guy came to me and said, you were up in Boston, you're talking Cheech and Chong, what are they trying to say? What could I tell them in one sentence in their movie? What are they trying to say? What is their message?
Relax. Relax.
Our message is anybody can do it.
Yeah, we subscribe to the Andy Warhol theory of popism. Popism is the easiest thing to do. And that's what we do. We do what's easiest to us.
Yeah.
You never tell them to tell people anything?
Inadvertently.
If there's a
but
message.
But usually the message is opposite of what we're trying to say.
Yeah. The times that we tried or, you know, maybe thought we might put a message in never worked, but the messages always came up, you know, after the fact. I mean, you look at it, you can read anything into a lot of it.
It's a real gestalt, you know, it's when you see an image emerging after the whole kind of thing. Oh, is that what that meant? Oh, great.
And then once you start going for it, then once you see it, then you know, that's why if you work with a script, there again, you say, okay, let's get serious, you know. But if you don't have, you know, if you're not rigidly set, and you see the way a scene's going, it's going a certain way, and you say, oh, great! Instead of that, we'll do this, and so that's the way we do it.
Yeah. What's the gestalt of the welfare office scene when you disappear over the banner, and the guy next to you is, you know, blowing marbles in your ear or everything?
That was the scene. There was another scene where we like to put all these things in there, you know, so that every time you see it, you know, you can see a certain thing.
Reminding
you
about that.
Yeah,
you can see.
Exactly.
You watch The Junkie one time. If you see the movie again, watch The Junkie Not Out.
It's classic.
It's just classic, because we used a real junkie. You
know? Used to be our manager. Truth.
This is our new manager now.
He's the father of the Cats and Jammer kids.
Who's the black guy who did all the routines?
Michael Winslow.
Michael Winslow.
Yeah. He's a guy that walked in the office. He's a comedian around town in L.A., and that's his specialty. He does those funny voices and stuff, and we go, great, we got a place. See, we design stuff around people's talents, you know?
Yeah.
Go, well, we got to find a place for him to go crazy and do his thing where it makes sense.
Where it'll work.
Yeah, where it'll work. Put him in the office and just sit there and watch him. That's all you had to do with Michael. And he's real funny. Real funny guy. We're real, very fortunate in getting a lot of really good actors and actresses.
Who's that other troupe that you use?
The Groundlings.
Yeah, we don't know who they are.
They're an improv company from LA.
There's a lot of improv companies in Los Angeles, and this is one group that we found that were, you know, they weren't that good, so they were funny. They had to rely on, you know, like cheap jokes. And so we loved that, so we used them.
No.
Good actors.
The one girl, Edie McClurg, is just, she's a real great actress.
The mother and the good side.
What is she?
How old is she?
She's about 32, 33. Yeah.
Wasn't that amazing?
She's not raising
a mother, or I could be her father. You know?
She's a regular now on the David Letterman show. She's on The Big Show, and she's been around for a little while, but never got a big break in movies. And she's just the best comedian I've ever worked with.
You know, technically, you must have decided that you wanted sharper photography this time around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this thing is clear. Last time, I didn't know where the blue haze came from.
Well, this picture was different in that there was a bunch of scenes in a row the same color, you know? Which we thought was just great. You know? Wow, this is movie making, you know?
Well, King Baggett, our photographer, we used to get up at 3 in the morning to check the prints after we shot maybe half the night, and he'd be there 3 in the morning. He almost had a nervous breakdown because he wanted to make sure that this looked great, and because his reputation depended on it.
This is his first movie.
Yeah. Mm. And the people, the technical people at Universal, and that, they were just, I think it was exciting for them too, as well as us, and so they were really involved. Up in Smoke, Lou had the control, and you know, and he was almost like afraid to let the control go to people. We were the opposite. We'd give everybody all the room in the world to work, and we let the technicians do their bit.
The first movie was like a swatch book. You know, it was a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Different colors, different textures. Oh, that's a big pile. That's no pile. That's, you know, purple and green. Just we came out of the first movie thinking that if we had two good scenes that crack people up, then we had a future movie.
It was Mel. Doesn't Mel Brooks have a joke about that? Three solid laughs is a blockbuster, or is it six or something?
He may be right. Mm-hmm. He may be right. Yeah.
It's tough. Yeah, it's not as easy as it looks.
Are you in the process of putting something together now?
We're in the process of doing another movie. While we sit here right now, the money's ticking away. You know how much it's costing you?
Along the same lines as this one.
Probably, yeah. New adventures, watching these guys go someplace different.
Yeah, they can go on the road. That's
yeah, eventually
funny.
They were. I just came back from Barbados, and I think we're going to go there.
I think we're going to play more music in this next one.
Retrace Easy Rider or something.
Yeah.
I think we're going to do a little more music that we play ourselves and get involved in this.
We've been starting that end up of it up and of it up. We're unencumbered by language.
You ever think about marketing your song Mexican American?
I'd like to make a disco version of it. Yeah. Yeah, it'll be music kind of along those lines. You know? Yeah. This is real hard to write. Mm. it's like punk protest.
Are you still working on a hardcover book for Putnam?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We figured out how to do it now. We're going to transcribe all our interviews. Don't laugh. We're serious.
Yeah.
You know, some of this stuff, you know, it's all on tape. We get someone to type it up.
We got a book.
Give
us more money.
How do you allocate your time? How do you allocate your time when you're working on a movie, a new record that just came out, a hardcover book? I mean, are you doing it all at once, a little bit here, sit around the living room and talk, oh, that's a good bit, we'll put that in the book?
No.
We do, let's take a vacation first.
Yeah. I'm hoping that the book will just kind of happen. I mean, that's like my philosophy, you know. And I'll walk, oh, it's done, far out. Is the check here?
One thing at a time.
Yeah.
That's why we put our Columbia movie off, you know, a few weeks, so we could do just interviews and get that. So we don't have to be, you know, dividing our time. It never works, because you always have to go back and redo it anyway, so. This way we'll get the interviews and we'll take care of all the promo for this movie and have that totally out of the way, and then we'll go into the next movie and we'll do the Columbia movie, and that's the way we work. The book, I don't know. Like Chief says, we'll hope it'll just happen somewhere along the line.
How long do you spend on each project?
As long as it takes. Sometimes, yeah, a movie usually takes a year from start to finish.
Wow. People always ask us, how long do your albums take? It depends on how rich you were at the time.
Yeah.
And that's the truth. Sometimes if it's not pressing, you know, it'll get done, I suppose. Could you get another rum and coke? Yeah. First one didn't take that long because we already had the material. We'd been working on it for years. Second one, you use some more of the material, then you start making up more. Third one, it's like mainstream.
You got Mexican work habits. If the car is paid for, there's no reason to work.
The car is paid for.
You guys have been rich and you've been poor, and rich is better, I know. But yeah. How does it change your lifestyle, basically?
Well, you find out you got a lot more relatives than you.
Basically, very little. You know, I mean, now we go to places and we could stay in the good hotel or the good house. But usually we used to stay in the same place in the gardener shack next to it and enjoy the same beach, you know. So
now we don't have to lie about what room we're in. I live here. Why?
Who are you?
I left my identification.
Who we then? Yeah, I got stopped in Miami Beach one time, guys. You know, do you live here? I said, why? Who are you? Well, I'm security. Threw him off. I said, let me see some ID. So he showed me his ID. Okay, thanks, you can go.
Is that the attitude? Is it your attitude that if the car is paid for, there's no reason to work, and all that kind of stuff, your approach to all your projects, so if you're waiting for the book to be done, is that why you haven't burned out or destroyed yourselves like
probably
a lot of people,
exactly,
like Richard Pryor? For instance.
Yeah.
Yeah, Richard sort of got burned out, didn't he?
Let's get in touch,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's it.
It's like you can't eat tacos and enchiladas every day, man. You know, unless you want a colon that big. You know, it's like, okay, every once in a while. So that's why we're not in people's faces all the time. You know, we come out with a movie every couple years. Every now and then. We don't, there's no, you know. I gotta be me. We are me.
Household words. Yeah. And it works in our favor too, because there's no, they can't hold us ransom. You know, they can't say, well, you know, you'll never get this if you, you know, there's no hold on us. If we either get what we want or we don't do it.
Do something else. Hey man, I dug ditches and delivered carpets and cleaned up parking lots.
I was just reading something on the plane up here about Richard Pryor and why things happen the way they do to him, and it's that he's been in the same place you've been, poor, and had a rotten life, and he's up there, and he doesn't know why he's up there, and doesn't think he's doing it right, or he doesn't think he deserves it, and you don't have any bothers about that. You just light up a joint.
Well, that's the joy of a team, you know, because when one of us gets a little crazy, the other one can sort of mellow him out. There's a politeness between us, you know, that makes everything work, that keeps it even. But I can imagine being a lone act, you know. You're plagued by fears. I mean, you have nightmares.
You got nowhere to run, man. We went on the road 10 years, and some of the stuff was just soul-killing as well as elating, man. If you didn't have somebody to say, well, you look at that shit there and crack up, and then you go nuts.
Or to share it, totally. And no one can share it with you if you're by yourself. I think that's what probably killed Lenny and probably Freddie Prinze, you know. You got no one to say, hey, you know.
No equal.
No one to hang on to. I mean, everybody else is hired. They don't have that feeling. And you lose your friends because, you know, you're in a different economic level. And then you get paranoid. You can get paranoid, you can be totally straight, no drugs at all, and be paranoid about, you know, people around you because you have and they don't, and they're there to, they live off you, but you need them, and, you know, it's so confusing. It's like being alone, an alien from another planet, you know, here you are.
We were influenced by early wrestling. You know, when you, really, seriously, you know, my favorite guys were the tag team, the Gomez brothers, you know? And the other guy jumping, and do a triple somersault off the top rope and land on the guy's stomach. You know? That's how we are, man. Yeah. Take over this guy for me, will you please?
The team, you know, there's so many combinations. There's so many ways you can go at it. And so many ways we can protect each other and help each other. And some of that is like looking at a guy and saying, hey, you got shit on your beard, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas if you're alone, no one tells you that. And then you look in the mirror and you say, oh, I've been looking like this the whole day. How come you didn't tell me? No one cares.
Yeah.
And then you say, oh, you
know.
You
got really cool little signals like.
No, it's tough.
We have time for one more question.
Okay. So I'd like it to be.
Can you imagine yourselves, I mean, you ever see a comedy routine, yourselves at 85 years old and the...
Sure.
Sure. We'll be doing something.
George Burns, man, I mean, he's smart. I mean, why do you think all those young chicks come around him?
He's got money.
They wouldn't come down to the old age home and get him. You know, but if once you're on TV or you're an entertainer, you know, it doesn't matter how old you are. You're some kind of mystique. You still get the best table in the restaurant. Entertaining is so easy. That's the easiest part of the whole gig, is getting up on stage and doing it. The hardest part is getting up the plane to go to where you're doing it. You know? That's what it is.
Oh, I like this.
We even
part.
Turned that into a plus for us. You know?
This is stage right now.
Thank
it's
you.
Fun.
Thank you,
thank you very much.